and did not pay much attention at the time. No one did. You may have noticed that a wooden facade was added to two walls. The cupboard wall. I thought it was built so that cook had a bigger larder, one that kept rats out. It made the room smaller, but warmer as well. And above the cupboards there is a passageway, and several viewing slits. Shrewd liked to know what his guards were thinking of him, what they feared, what they hoped. But the men who built it would have known of it. Different craftsmen were brought in to do different parts of the job. I myself added the viewing slits. If any of them thought it odd that the ceilings of the cupboards were so sturdily built, they said nothing. And here we are. Hush. He lifted a tiny leather flap on the wall and peered into the revealed hole. After a moment, he whispered, "Come." The silent door admitted us into a privy chamber. Then we paused again, while Shade again peered through a peephole, then tapped lightly at the door.
"Enter,"
Katrikan responded quietly. I followed Shade into a small sitting room off the Queen's bedchamber. The connecting door to the bedchamber was closed and a bolt in place. The room was decorated sparsely in the mountain's severe but restful way. Fat, scented candles gave us light in the windowless chamber. The table and chairs were of bare, pale wood. The woven mat on the floor and the wall hangings were made of grass worked into a scene of waterfalls tumbling down a mountainside. I recognized Katrikan's own handiwork. Other than that, the chamber was bare. All this I noticed peripherally, for my queen stood in the center of the room. She was waiting for us. She wore a simple gown of buck blue, with a white and gold kirtle. Her gold hair was dressed close to her head, and crowned only with a simple band of silver. She was empty-handed. Another woman would have brought her needlework or had set out a platter of food, but not our queen. She was waiting for us, but I did not sense impatience or anxiety. I suspected she had been meditating, for an aura of stillness still clung to her. Our eyes met, and the small lines at the corners of her mouth and eyes seemed lies, for in the gaze we shared no time had passed at all. The courage I had always admired still shone there, and her self-discipline was like an armor she wore. Yet, "Oh, Fitz!" she cried low on seeing me, and in her voice there was warm welcome and relief. I bowed low to her, and then sank on one knee. "My queen," I greeted her. She stepped forward and touched my head, her hand a benediction. "Please rise," she said quietly. "You have been at my side through too many trials for me ever to want to see you on your knees before me. And, as I recall, you once called me Katrikan." "That was many years ago, my lady," I reminded her as I rose. She took both my hands in hers. We were nearly of a height, and her blue eyes looked deep into mine. "Far too many, for which I fault you, Fitzchivalry. But Shade told me long ago that you might choose solitude and rest for yourself. When you did, I did not begrudge it to you. You had sacrificed everything to your duty, and if solitude was the only reward you wished, then I was glad to grant it to you. Yet I confess I am more glad to see you return, especially at such a time of crisis." "If you have need of me, then I am glad to be here," I replied, almost without reservations. "I am saddened that you walk among the folk of Buckkeep and none know what sacrifices you have made for them. You should have been accorded a hero's welcome. Instead, you walk unknown among them in the guise of a servant." Her earnest blue eyes searched my own. I found myself smiling. Perhaps I spent too long in the mountains, where all know that the true ruler of that kingdom is the servant of all. For a moment her blue eyes widened. Then the genuine smile that broke forth on her face was like the sun breaking through storm clouds, despite the sudden tears that stood in her eyes. "Oh, Fitz, to hear you say such words is balm to my heart. Truly you have been sacrifice for your people, and I admire you for it, but to hear from your lips that you understand that it has been your duty, and took satisfaction in that, brings me joy." I did not think that was exactly what I had said, and yet I will not deny that her praise eased some of the ancient hurt in me. I pulled back from looking at that too closely. "Dutiful," I said suddenly. He is why I'm here, and much pleasure as I take in this reunion, I would take even more in discovering what has become of him. My queen kept possession of one of my hands, and held it tightly as she drew me towards the table. Oh, you were ever my friend, even before I came as a stranger to this court. And now your heart goes with mine in this matter. She drew a deep breath, and the fears and worries of a mother broke past the control in the monarch's voice as she said, No matter how I dissemble before the court, and it grieves me that I must deceive my own people this way, my son is never out of my thoughts for a moment. Fitzchivalry, I put the blame for this at my own feet. Yet I do not know if my fault was too much discipline for him, or too little, or if I demanded too much of the prince and not enough of the boy, or... My queen, you cannot approach this problem from that direction. We must begin from where we are. No good will come of trying to apportion blame. I will tell you bluntly that in my brief time here I have discovered nothing. Those who I have questioned speak well of the prince. No one has divulged to me that he was unhappy or discontented in any way. Then you think he was taken? She broke in. This interruption was so uncharacteristic of Cotricken that I finally grasped the depth of her anguish. I drew out a chair for her, and as she sat I looked down into her face, and said with all the calm I could muster, I do not think anything yet. I do not have enough facts to form an opinion. At an impatient sign from her, both Shade and I were seated at the table. But what of your skill? She demanded. Does it tell you nothing of him? Shade told me that he suspected you and the boy were somehow linked in your dreams. I do not understand how that could be so, but if it is, surely it must tell you something. What has he dreamed these last few nights? You will not like my answer, my queen, any more than you liked my answer all those years ago, when we searched for verity. My talent now is, as it was then, erratic and unreliable. From what Shade has told me, it is possible that I have occasionally shared a dream with Prince Dutiful, but if it is so, I was not cognizant of it at the time, nor can I break into his dreams at will. If he has dreamed these last few nights, he dreamed alone.
Or perhaps he did not dream at all, Cotricken mourned. Perhaps he is dead already, or tormented so he cannot sleep and dream.
My queen, you imagine the worst, and when you do, your mind stops at the problem and does not consider the solution. Chade's voice was almost severe. Knowing how tormented he was over the boy's absence, his sternness surprised me, until I saw the queen's reaction. Cotricken took strength from his firmness.
Of course. You are right.
She took a breath.
But what can our solution be? We have discovered nothing, and neither has Fitzchivalry. You have counseled me to keep his disappearance a secret, lest we panic the people and precipitate rash decisions. But there have been no demands for ransom. Perhaps we should make it public that the prince is missing. Someone, somewhere, must know something. I think we must announce it and ask the people to help.
Not yet, I heard myself say. For you are right in saying that someone, somewhere, must know something, and if they are aware that the prince is absent from Buckkeep and they have not come forwards, then they have a reason. And I should like to know what it is.
Then what do you suggest?
Cotricken demanded of me.
What is left to us?
I knew it would chafe her, yet I still suggested it. Give me a little more time. A day, at most two. Let me ask more questions and sniff about some more.
But anything could have happened to him by then.
Anything could have happened to him by now, I pointed out levelly. I spoke calmly the cruel words. Cotricken, if someone took him to kill him, they have done it by now. If they took him to use him, they are still awaiting our move in this game. If he ran away, then he may yet run home again. While we keep his absence a secret, the next move belongs to us. Let it be known, and others will make that move for us. You will have nobles tearing up the countryside looking for him, and not all will have his best interests at heart. Some will want to rescue him to curry favour, and others may think to seize a prize from another weasel's jaws. She closed her eyes but nodded reluctantly to my words. When she spoke, her voice was strained.
But you know that time runs out for us. Shade has told you that an out-islander contingent comes to formalize Prince Dutiful's affiance? When they arrive a fortnight from now, I must be able to produce him, or I risk not only embarrassment but also insult, and an end to a carefully wrought truce that I hope to make an alliance. Bought with your son. The words leapt out of my mouth before I knew I had thought them. She opened her eyes and gazed at me levelly. Yes, as the mountain alliance with the six duchies was bought with me. She cocked her head at me. Do you consider it a poor transaction? A deserved rebuke. I bowed my head to it. No, my queen, I think it was the best bargain that the six duchies ever made. She nodded to my compliment, and a faint blush rose in her cheeks. I shall listen to your counsel, Fitz. Two more days will we seek Dutiful on our own, before we reveal his absence to our people. In those days we will use every means at our disposal to discover what may have become of him. Chade has opened to you the concealed maze within the walls of Buckkeep. I little like what it says of us, but we furtively spy on our own folk. But I grant the freedom of it to you, Fitzchivalry. I know you will not abuse it. Use it as seems wise to you. Thank you, my queen, I replied awkwardly. I did not truly welcome this gift. The access to every lord's and lady's small and grubby floors. I did not glance at Shade. What had it cost him to be privy not just to the massive secrets of the throne, but the dirty and shameful sins of the folk of the keep? What vices had he inadvertently witnessed? What painful shortcomings had he glimpsed? And how did he meet the eyes of those folk every day in the broad and well-lit chambers of the keep? And whatever you must do. My mind had been wandering, but my queen was looking at me, waiting. I made the only possible response. Yes, my queen. She gave a great sigh, as if she had feared my refusal, or as if she dreaded what she next must say. Then do so, Fitzchivalry. Ever friend. I would not spend you this way if it could be avoided. Safeguard your health. Be wary of the drugs and herbs, for as thorough as your master is, no translation should ever be absolutely trusted. She took a breath, then added in a different tone, If either Chade or I press you too hard, tell us so. Your head must stand guard against my mother's heart. Do not let me shame myself in this way by asking more of you than you can. Her voice trailed away. I think she trusted me to take her meaning. She drew another breath. She turned her head and looked away from me, as if that would keep me from knowing that tears stood in her eyes. You will begin tonight? She asked, in an unnaturally high voice. I knew what I had just agreed to. I knew then that I stood at the lip of the abyss. I flung myself into it. Yes, my queen. How shall I describe that long climb up the stairs to the tower? Shade led the way through the secret places of the keep, and I followed his uncertain lamplight. Dread and anticipation warred inside me. I felt I had left my stomach far behind me, and yet I longed for him to hurry up the steps. Excitement coursed through me as we approached that indulgence so long denied to me. My hopes and focus should have been on recovering the prince, but the prospect of drowning myself in skill dominated all my thoughts. It terrified and tantalized me. My skin felt taut and alive, and my senses seemed to strain against the confines of my flesh. Music seemed to move through the air at the edges of my hearing. Shade triggered the door's opening and then gestured for me to precede him. As I edged past him, he observed, "You look nervous as a bridegroom, boy." I cleared my throat. It seems strange to rush headlong into that which I have tried to school myself to avoid. He shut the door behind us as I glanced about the room. A small fire burned on the grate. Even in the height of summer, the thick stone walls of the keep seemed to whisper a chill into the room. Verity's sword leaned up against the hearth where I had left it, but someone had removed the leather on the hilt. "You recognized Verity's blade," I observed.
"How could I not? I'm glad you kept it safe."
I laughed. More like that it kept me safe. Well,
What exactly do you propose?
I suggest you make yourself comfortable and that you attempt to skill out after the prince. That is all.
I looked around for a place to sit. Not on the hearthstones. Yet, as it ever had been, there was only one comfortable chair near the fire.
And the drugs and herbs the queen mentioned?
Chade gave me a sidelong glance. I thought I detected some wariness in the look.
I do not think we will need them.
She refers to several scrolls within the skill collection. There are teas and tinctures that are suggested for skill students who seem to have difficulty attaining a receptive state. We had considered using them on Prince Dutiful, but had decided to postpone it until we were sure they are necessary.
Galen never used any herbs when he was instructing us.
I brought a tall stool from the workbench and set it opposite Chade's chair. I perched on it. He settled in his chair, but then had to look up at me. I suspect it annoyed him. He sounded peevish when he spoke.
Galen never used any herbs when he was instructing you.
Did you never suspect that perhaps the others in your skill coterie received special attentions that you were not privy to?
I did.
Of course, we will never be certain of that.
I shrugged my shoulders to that. What else could I do?
It was years ago, and they were all dead, several of them at my hands. What did it matter now?
But the thoughts had stirred my old aversion to the skill. From anticipation, I had shifted suddenly to dread.
I changed the subject. Did you find out for me who gave the cat to the prince?
Chade looked startled at my abrupt shift.
Yes, of course.
Lady Bressinga of Gelaton, and her son Sybil. It was a birthday gift. The cat was presented to him in a little jeweled harness with a leash. The animal was about 2 years old, a long-legged, stripy creature with a rather flat face and a tail as long as the rest of it. I understand those cats cannot be bred, that a kitten must be taken from a wild den before its eyes have opened, if anything is to be made of it. It is an exotic, coursing animal suited to solitary hunting. The prince took to it immediately.
Who took the kitten from the den? I asked.
I have no idea. They are huntsmen, I imagine.
Did the cat like the prince?
Chade frowned to himself. I had not really concerned myself with that. As I recall, they approached the dais with Lady Bressinga holding the end of the cat's leash and her son actually carrying the animal. It seemed almost dazed by all the light and noise of the festivities. I wondered myself if they had drugged it, lest it panic to struggle to escape. But when they had made their courtesies to the prince, the lady put the end of the leash in his hand, and Sybil, her son, set the cat at Dutiful's feet.
Did it try to get away? Did it test the leash?
No. As I said, it seemed quite calm, almost unnaturally so. I believe it looked at the prince for a time, and then bumped its head against his knee.
Chade's eyes had gone distant, and I saw his trained mind recalling the scene in detail.
He reached down to stroke it, and it cowered away. Then it sniffed his hand. Then it did this strange thing, opening its mouth wide and breathing near his hand, as if it could taste his scent from the air. After that, it seemed to accept him. It rubbed its head up and down his leg, just as a little cat does. When a servant tried to lead it away, it would not go, so it was allowed to remain near the prince's chair for the rest of the evening. He seemed very well pleased with it.
How soon did he begin hunting it?
I believe he and Sybil took it out the next day. Sybil and the prince are nearly of an age, and the prince was eager to try the cat, as any boy would be. Sybil and his mother stayed on at court the rest of the week, and I think that Sybil and the prince took out the cat every morning. It was his chance to learn how to hunt with it, you see, from people familiar with the sport.
And did they hunt well together?
Oh, I suppose so. It is not for large game, of course, but they brought back, birds, I think, and hares.
And it always slept in his room.
As I understand it, it has to be kept close to a human to keep it tamed. And, of course, the hounds in the stable would not have left it in peace. So, yes, it slept in his room and followed him about the keep.
Fitz, what do you suspect?
I answered him honestly.
The same thing that you do.
That our witted prince has vanished with his hunting cat companion.
and that none of this is a coincidence, not the gift of the animal, not the bonding, not the disappearance. Someone planned this. Shade frowned, not wanting to admit what he believed. The cat could have been killed when the prince was taken, or she could have run off.
So you've said, but if the prince is witted and the cat is bonded to him, she would not have run off when he was taken.
The stool was uncomfortable, but I stubbornly remained perched on it. I closed my eyes for a moment. Sometimes when the body is weary, the mind takes flight. I let my thoughts skip where they would. I've bonded thrice, you know. The first time to Nosy, the puppy that Burrick took from me. And again to Smithy, when I was still a boy. The last time to Night Eyes. Each time, there was that instant sense of connection. With Nosy, I bonded before I was even aware I was doing it. I suspect it happened because I was lonely. Because when Smithy offered love, I accepted it with no discrimination. And when the wolf's anger and hatred of his cage so exactly matched mine, I could not distinguish between us. I opened my eyes briefly and met Chade's startled stare. I had no walls, you see. I looked away from him, down at the dwindling fire. From what I've been told, in witted families, the children are protected from doing that. They are taught to have walls when they are young. Then, when they are of an age, they are sent out to find suitable partners, almost like seeking a suitable marriage partner. What are you suggesting? Chade asked quietly. I followed the thought where it led me. The Queen has chosen a bride for Prince Dutiful for the sake of a political alliance. What if an old blood family has done the same? A lengthy silence followed my words. I looked back at Chade. His eyes were on the fire, and I could almost see his mind working frantically to sort out all the implications of what I had said. An old blood family deliberately selects an animal for the prince to bond with. Assumptions, then, that Lady Brisinga is witted, that indeed her whole line is, as you put it, old blood, that they somehow knew or suspected the prince is also witted. He paused, pursed his mouth, and considered. Perhaps they were the source of the note claiming the prince was witted. I still do not grasp what they would profit from it. What do we profit from marrying Dutiful to some out-islander girl? An alliance, Chade. He scowled at me. The cat somehow is part of the Brisinga family and retains ties to it? The cat can somehow influence the prince's political actions? The way he said it made it seem ridiculous. I haven't got it completely worked out yet, I admitted, but I think there is something there. Even if their only goal is to prove that the prince himself is witted, and hence that other witted folk should not be chopped up and burned for being the way they are, or to gain the prince's sympathy towards witted folk, and through him, the queen's. Chade gave me a sidelong glance. Now that is a motive I can concede. There is also possible blackmail there. Once they have bonded the prince to an animal, they can hold out for political favours under the threat that they will tell others he is witted. He looked aside from me. Or attempt to reduce him to the level of an animal if we do not comply with their political wishes. As always, Chade's mind was capable of far more convolutions than mine was. It was almost a relief to have him refine my ideas. I did not want my mentor to be failing in mind or body. In so many ways, he still stood as a shield between me and the world. I nodded to his suggestions. He stood up suddenly. So, all the more reason we should proceed as we had planned. Come, take my chair. You look like a parrot perched up there. You cannot possibly be comfortable. One thing all the basic scrolls stress is that a practitioner of the skill should find a comfortable starting place, one in which the body is relaxed and unobtrusive to the mind. I opened my mouth to say that was the opposite of what Galen had done to us. On the contrary, when he was teaching us, he had made us so miserable in body that the mind became our only escape. I shut my mouth, the words unsaid. Useless to protest or ponder what Galen had done. The twisted, pleasureless man had tormented us all,
and those he had succeeded in training he had warped into a mindlessly loyal coterie for Prince Regal. Perhaps that had something to do with it. Perhaps he had wanted to break down the body's resistance and the mind's judgment before he could shape them into the coterie he desired. I sat down in Chade's chair. It retained his warmth and the imprint of his body. It felt strange to sit there, in his presence. It was as if I were becoming him. He assumed my perch on the stool and looked down on me from that towering height. He crossed his arms on his chest and leaned forwards to smirk down at me.
"Comfortable?"
he asked me. "No," I admitted. "Serves you right," he muttered. Then, with a laugh, he got off the stool. "Tell me what I can do to help you with this process. You want me to just sit here and skill out, hoping to find the prince? Is that so hard?" It was a genuine question. "I tried for several hours last night. Nothing happened except that I got a headache."
"Oh."
For a moment he looked discouraged. Then he announced firmly, "We will simply have to try again." In a lower voice he muttered, "For what else can we do?" I could think of no answer to that. I leaned back in his chair and tried to relax my body. I stared at his mantelpiece, only to have my attention stick on a fruit knife driven into the wood. I had done that years ago. Now was not the time to dwell on that incident. Yet I found myself saying, "I crept into my old room today. It looks as if it had not been used since last I slept there."
"It hasn't. Castle tradition says it is haunted."
"You're joking."
"No, think about it. The witted bastard slept there, and he was taken to his death in the castle dungeons. It's a fine basis for a ghost tale. Besides, flickering blue lights have been seen through its shutters at night, and once a stable boy said he saw the pocked man staring down from that window on a moonlit night."
"You kept it empty?"
"I am not entirely devoid of sentiment. And for a long time I hoped you would someday return to that room, but enough of this. We have a task."
I drew a breath. The Queen did not mention the note about the prince being witted.
"No, she did not."
"Do you know why?"
He hesitated. "Perhaps some things are so frightening that even our good Queen cannot bring herself to consider them."
"I'd like to see the note."
"And then you shall. Later."
He paused, then asked me heavily,
"Fitz, are you going to settle down and do this thing, or keep procrastinating?"
I took a deliberate breath, blew it out slowly, and fixed my gaze on the dwindling fire. I looked into its heart as I gradually unfastened my mind from my thoughts. I opened myself to the skill. My mind began to unfold. I have, over the years, given much thought to how one could describe skilling. No metaphor really does it justice. Like a folded piece of silk, the mind opens and opens and opens again, becoming larger and yet somehow thinner. That is one image. Another is that the skill is like a great unseen river that flows at all time. When one consciously pays attention to it, one can be seized in its current and drawn out to flow with it. In its wild waters, minds can touch and merge. Yet no words or similes do it justice, any more than words can explain the smell of fresh bread or the colour yellow. The skill is the skill. It is the hereditary magic of the Farseers, yet it does not belong to kings alone. Many folk in the Six Duchies have a touch of it. In some it burns strong enough that even a skilled one can hear their thoughts. Sometimes I can even influence what a skill-touched person thinks. Far more rare are those who can reach out with the skill. That ability is usually no more than a feeble groping unless the talent is trained. I opened myself to it, and let my consciousness expand, but with no expectations of reaching anyone. Threads of thought tangled against me like waterweed. "I hate the way she looks at my bow. I wish I could say one last word to you, Papa. Please hurry home, I feel so ill. You are so beautiful. Please, please, turn around, see me, at least give me that." Those who flung the thoughts out with such urgency were, for the most part, ignorant of their own strength. None of them was aware of me sharing their thoughts, nor could I make my own thoughts known to them.
Each cried out in their deafness with voices they believed were mute. None was Prince Dutiful. From some distant part of the keep, music reached my ears, temporarily distracting me. I pushed it aside and strove on. I do not know how long I prowled amongst those unwary minds, nor how far I reached in my search. The range of the skill is determined by strength of ability, not distance. I had no measure of my strength, and time does not exist when one is in the grip of the skill. I trod again that narrow measure, clinging to my awareness of my own body, despite the temptation to let the skills sweep me free of my body forever. "Fitz," I murmured in response to something, and then, "Fitz Chivalry," I said aloud to myself. A fresh log cracked down onto the embers of the fire, scattering the glowing heart into individual coals. For a time I stared at it, trying to make sense of what I was seeing. Then I blinked and became aware of Chade's hand resting on my shoulder. I smelled hot food, and slowly turned my head. A platter rested on a low table near the chair. I stared at it, wondering how it had come to be there. "Fitz," Chade said again, and I tried to recall his question. "What? Did you find Prince Dutiful?" Each word gradually made sense to me until I perceived his query. "No," I said, as a wave of weariness rolled over me. "No, nothing." In the wake of the fatigue, my hands began to tremble and my head to pound. I closed my eyes but found no relief. Even with my eyes closed, snakes of light trembled across the dark. When I opened my eyes, they were superimposed on the room before me. I felt as if too much light were getting inside my head. Waves of pain tumbled me in a surf of disorientation. "Here, drink this." Chade put a warm mug into my hands, and I lifted it gratefully to my mouth. I took a mouthful, then nearly spat it out. It was not elf bark tea to soothe my headache, but only beef broth. I swallowed it without enthusiasm. "Elf bark tea," I reminded him. "That is what I need right now, not food." "No, Fitz, recall what you yourself told me. Elf bark stunts the skill ability and numbs you to your talent. That is something we cannot risk just now. Eat something. It will restore your strength." Obediently, I looked at the tray. Sliced fruit floated in cream next to freshly baked bread. There was a glass of wine and pink slices of baked river fish. I carefully set the mug of broth down next to the revolting stuff and turned my gaze away. The fire was rekindling itself, dancing licks of flame too bright. I lowered my face into my hands, seeking darkness. But even there, the light still danced before my eyes. I spoke into my hands. "I need some elf bark. It has not been this bad in years, not since Verity was alive, not since Shrewd took strength from me. Please, Chade, I cannot even think." He went away. I sat counting my heartbeats until he came back. Each thud of my heart was a flare of pain in my temples. I heard the scuff of his steps and lifted my head. "Here," he said gruffly, and set a cool, wet cloth to my forehead. The shock of it made me catch my breath. I held it to my brow and felt the thudding ease somewhat. It smelled of lavender. I looked at him through a haze of pain. His hands were empty. "The elf bark tea," I reminded him. "No, Fitz." "Chade, please. It hurts so badly, I can't see." Each word was an effort. My own voice was too loud. "I know," he said quietly. "I know, my boy, but you will just have to bear it. The scrolls say that sometimes the use of the skill brings this pain, but that with time and repeated effort, you will learn to master it. Again, my understanding of it is imperfect, but it seems to have to do with the split effort you make, both to reach out from yourself and to hold tight to yourself. Given time, you will learn how to reconcile those tensions and then..." "Chade!" I did not mean to bellow, but I did. "I just need the damned elf bark tea, please!" I took sudden control of myself. "Please," I added softly, contritely. "Please, just the tea. Just help me ease this pain, and then I could listen to you." "No, Fitz. Chade!" I spoke my hidden fear.
Pain, such as this, could push me into a seizure. I saw a brief flicker of uncertainty in his eyes, but then...
I don't think it will. Besides, I'm here beside you, boy. I'll take care of you. You have to try to get through this without the drug, for dutiful sake, for the six duchies.
His refusal stunned me into silence. Hurt and defiance tore me.
Fine.
I bit off the word. I have some in my pack in my room. I tried to find the will to stand. A moment of silence. Then, unwillingly, he admitted, "You had some in your pack in your room. It is gone. As is the carry-me that was with it." I took the rag from my forehead and glared at him, my anger built on the foundation of my pain.
"You have no right. How dare you?"
He took a breath.
"I dare as much as my need demands, and my need is great."
His green-eyed gaze met mine challengingly.
"The throne needs the talent that only you possess. I will allow nothing that diminishes your skill."
He did not look away from me, but I could scarcely keep my eyes on him. Light was flaring all around him, stabbing into my brain. The barest edge of control kept me from throwing the compress at him. As if he guessed that, he took it from me, offering me a freshly cooled one in its place. It was a pitiful comfort, but I put it to my brow and leaned back in the chair. I wanted to weep with frustration and anguish. From behind the compress, I told him,
"Pain. That's what being a farseer means to me. Pain and being used."
He made no reply. That had always been his greatest rebuke, the silence that forced me to hear my own words over and over. When I took the cloth from my forehead, he was ready with another one. As I pressed it to my eyes, he said mildly,
"Pain and being used. I've known my share of that as a farseer, as did verity, and chivalry, and shrewd before them. But you know there is more than that. If there weren't, you wouldn't be here."
"Perhaps," I conceded grudgingly. The fatigue was winning. I just wanted to curl up around the pain and sleep, but I fought it. "Perhaps, but it isn't enough. Not for going through this."
"And what more would you ask, Fitz? Why are you here?"
I knew he meant it to be a rhetorical question, but the anxiety had been with me for too long. The answer was too close to my lips, and the pain made me speak without thought. I lifted a corner of the cloth to peer at him.
"I do this because I want a future. Not for myself, but for my boy, for Hap. Shade, I've done it all wrong. I haven't taught him a thing, not how to fight, not how to make a living. I need to find him an apprenticeship with a good master. Gindas, that's who he wishes to teach him. He wants to be a joiner, and I should have seen that this would come and save my money, but I didn't. And here he is, of an age to learn, and I haven't a thing to give him. The coins I've saved aren't enough to—"
"I can arrange that." Chade spoke quietly. Then, almost angrily, he demanded,
"Did you think I wouldn't?"
Something in my face betrayed me, for he leaned closer, brows furrowed as he exclaimed,
"You thought you'd have to do this in order to ask my help, didn't you?"
The damp cloth was still in his hand. It slapped the stone flags when he flung it in a temper.
"Fitz, you—" he began.
Then words failed him. He stood up and walked away from me. I thought he would leave entirely. Instead, he went down to the workbench and the unused hearth at the other end of the chamber. He walked around the table slowly, looking at it and the scroll racks and utensils, as if seeking for something he had misplaced. I refolded the second cloth and held it to my forehead, but surreptitiously I watched him from under my hand. Neither of us said anything for a time. When he came back to me, he looked calmer, but somehow older. He took a fresh cloth from a pottery dish, wrung it out, folded it, and offered it to me. As we exchanged the compresses, he said softly,
"I'll see that Hap gets his apprenticeship. You could simply have asked me to do that when I visited you.
Or, years ago, you could have brought the lad to Buckkeep and we'd have seen him decently educated.
He can read and write and figure, I said defensively. I saw to that.
Good. His reply was chill. I'm glad to hear you retain that much common sense.
There seemed no rejoinder to that. Both pain and weariness were overcoming me. I knew I had hurt him, but I didn't feel it was my fault. How could I have known he'd be so willing to help me? Nevertheless, I apologized.
Chade, I'm sorry. I should have known that you would help me.
Yes, he agreed mercilessly. You should have.
And you're sorry. I don't doubt you're sincere.
Yet I seem to recall warning you years ago that those words will only work so often, and then they ring hollow.
Fitz, it hurts me to see you this way.
It's starting to ease, I lied.
Not your head, you stupid ass. It hurts me to see that you are still, as you've always been since...
Damn.
Since you were taken from your mother. Wary and isolated and mistrustful, despite all I've... After all these years, have you given your trust to no one?
I was silent for a time, pondering his words. I had loved Molly, but I had never trusted her with my secrets. My bond with Chade was as essential as my bones, but no, I had not believed that he would do all he could for Hap, simply for the sake of what we shared. Burrick, Verity, Catrickan, Lady Patience, Starling, in every instance I had held back.
I trust the fool, I said, and then wondered if I truly did.
I did, I assured myself. There was almost nothing about me that he didn't know. That was trust, wasn't it?
After a moment, Chade said heavily, Well, that's good, that you trust someone.
He turned away from me and spoke to the fire. You should force yourself to eat something. Your body may rebel, but you know that you need the food. Recall how we had to press food on Verity when he skilled? The neutrality in his voice was almost painful. I realized that he had hoped I would insist that I did trust him. It would not have been true, and I would not lie to him. I rummaged around in my mind for something else to give him. I spoke the words without thinking.
Chade, I do love you. It's just that...
He turned to me almost abruptly.
Stop, boy. Say no more.
His voice was almost pleading as he said, That's enough for me. He set his hand to my shoulder and squeezed nearly painfully. I won't ask of you that which you can't give.
You are what life has made you and what I made you, Ada, be merciful. Now, pay attention to me. Eat something. Force yourself if you must.
It would have been useless to tell him that the sight and smell of the food was enough to make me gag.
I took a breath and quaffed down the beef broth, not breathing until it was gone. The fruit and cream felt slimy in my mouth, the fish reeked and the bread near choked me, but I forced myself to swallow it half-chewed. I took a deep breath and the wine followed it down. When I set the cup down, my stomach churned and my head reeled. The wine was a more potent vintage than I had thought. I lifted my eyes to Chade's, his mouth hung ajar in dismay.
I didn't mean like that, he muttered. I lifted a hand at him in a gesture of futility. I feared to open my mouth to reply.
You best go to bed, he suggested humbly.
I nodded in reply and levered myself to my feet. He opened the door for me, gave me a candle, and then stood at the top of the passage holding a light until my path carried me out of his view. My room seemed impossibly distant, but eventually I arrived at the entry. Queasy as I was, I extinguished my light before I approached and carefully peered through the peephole before I triggered the access to my dark room. No candle burned there tonight. It didn't matter. I stumbled into the stuffy darkness and thrust the door shut behind me. A few steps carried me to my bed and I dropped onto it. I was too hot and my clothes bound me uncomfortably, but I was too tired to do anything about it. The black was so absolute I could not tell if my eyes were open or shut. At least the lights under my eyelids had been quenched. I stared up into the darkness and longed for the cool peace of the forest. The thick walls of the room muffled all sound and sealed me off from the night. It was like being sealed in a tomb. I closed my eyes to the blackness and listened to my headache thump with the beat of my heart. My stomach gurgled unhappily. I drew a deep breath and... "Forest," I said quietly to myself. "Night. Trees. Meadow." I reached for the comforting familiarity of the natural world. I painted in the details for myself, a light wind stirring in the treetops, stars flickering through rags of moving clouds, coolness, and the rich scents of the earth. Tension eased away from me, taking my pain with it. I drifted with my imagination, the packed earth of a game trail beneath my feet, and I was moving softly through the darkness, following my companion. She went more quietly than night itself, each step sure and swift. Try as I might, I could not keep up with her, I could not even catch a glimpse of her. I knew of her passage by her scent hanging in the night air, or by the still rushing bushes just ahead of me. My cat followed her, but I was not swift enough.
"Wait,"
I called to them.
"Wait," she mocked me. "Wait for you to ruin the night's hunting? No, I shall not wait. You shall make haste and do so silently. Have you learned nothing of me? Lightfoot am I, and night friend, and shadow stalker. Be you so, and come, come, come to share the night with me."
I hurried after her, drunk with the night and her presence, drawn as irresistibly as a moth is drawn to a candle. Her eyes were green, I knew, for she had told me, and her long tresses were black. I longed to touch her, but she was elusive and taunting, always ahead of me, never revealing herself to my eyes, let alone my touch. I could only run after her through the night, the breath rasping in my chest as she flew before me. I did not complain. I would prove myself worthy of her and win her. But my heart was thundering and my breath burning in my lungs. I crested the top of a hill and stopped for breath. Before me spread the vista of the river valley. The moon hovered round and yellow. Had we come so far, in one night's hunting? Far below me, the walls of Gallatin were a dark huddle of stone on the riverbank. A few isolated lights still shone yellow in the windows of the keep. I wondered who burned candles while the rest of the household slumbered.
"Do you long to sleep in a stuffy room mounded with blankets? Is that how you would squander a night such as this? Save sleep for when the sunlight can warm you. Save sleep for when the game is hidden in den or burrow. Hunt now, my clumsy one. Hunt with me. Prove yourself. Learn to be one with me. Think as I do. Move as I do. Or lose me forever."
I started to go after her. My thoughts snagged on something, delaying me. There was something I must do right now, something I must tell someone right now. Startled, I halted where I stood. The thought divided me. Part of me had to go, had to hunt at her heels before she left me behind, but another part of me stood still. I must tell him now, right now. I peeled myself free, separating while holding on to the knowledge I had gained. It flickered in my grasp, threatening to become the nonsense of a fading dream. I gripped the thought, letting all else fade. Hold it. Say it out loud. Cling to the word. Cling tight to the thought. Don't let it go. Don't let it melt away with the dream. "Gallatin!" I said the word aloud, sitting upright in my bed in the stifling darkness. My shirt stuck to me with sweat, and the skill headache had returned with clanging bells attached to it. It didn't matter. I lurched from my bed and began a patting search of the invisible walls. "Gallatin," I said aloud, lest the word slip from my grasp. "Prince Dutiful hunts near Gallatin."
Chapter 14. Laurel. There is a certain black stone, often finely veined with white or silver threading, that was extensively used by the elderlings in their construction. At least one quarry for this stone exists in the wild lands beyond the Mountain Kingdom, but it is almost certain that other sources for it exist, for it is difficult even to imagine how it might otherwise have been used in such large constructions in so many far-flung locations. It was used not only in the construction of their buildings, but also in the monoliths they raised at certain crossroads. Due to several odd qualities of the roads that the Elderlings constructed, it can be deduced that a ground or graveled form of the stone was also instrumental in their creation. Wherever the Elderlings built, this stone was a favored instrument, and even in the places that they seem to have visited only sporadically, monuments of this stone are found. A close scrutiny of the witness stones of Buckkeep will convince the examiner that although defaced by harsh weather or perhaps intentionally vandalized by men in ages past, the stone is of the same type. Some have suggested that the witness stones of Buckkeep and other oath stones throughout the six duchies were originally raised by the Elderlings for a very different purpose. I awoke in Chade's great four-poster bed in the tower chamber. I knew a few moments of disorientation before deciding this was not another dream. I was truly awake. I did not recall going to sleep, only sitting down on the side of the bed for a few moments. I was still dressed in yesterday's clothing. I sat up cautiously. The hammers and anvils in my head had subsided to a monotonous drumming. The room appeared empty, as someone had been there recently. Washwater steamed near the hearth, and a small covered dish of porridge kept warm near it. As soon as I discovered these items, I put them to good use. My stomach was still reluctant to accept food, but I ate stoically, knowing it was for the best. I washed, put on a kettle for tea, and then wandered down to the work table. A large map of Buck was unfurled across it. The corners were weighted with a mortar and two pestles and a teacup. An inverted wine glass rested on the map itself. When I lifted it, I found Gallatin underneath it. It was on a tributary of the Buck River, northwest of Buck and on the other side of the river from Buckkeep. I had never been there. I tried to recall what I knew of Gallatin and swiftly did so. Absolutely nothing. My wit alerted me to Chade's presence, and I turned as the hidden door swung open. He entered briskly. The tops of his cheeks were pink with the morning, and his white hair gleamed silver. Nothing invigorated the old man so much as fresh intrigue. "Ah, you're up. Excellent," he greeted me. "I managed to arrange an early breakfast with Lord Golden, despite the absence of his serving-man. He assured me that he could be ready to travel in a few hours. He's already concocted an excuse for the trip." "What?" I asked him, befuddled. Chade laughed aloud. "Bird feathers, of all things. Lord Golden has a number of interesting hobbies, but his most current fascination is feathers. The larger and brighter, the better. Gallatin borders on a wooded upland and has a reputation for pheasants, grouse, and whiptails. The latter have rather extravagant plumage, especially their tail feathers. He's already sent a runner on ahead to Lady Brisinga of Gallatin, entreating hospitality from her while on his quest. It won't be refused. Lord Golden is the most popular novelty that Buckkeep Court has seen in a decade. Having him guest at her manor will be a social coup for her." He paused, but it was I who took a breath. I shook my head as if it would settle my brains and enable me to catch up with him. "The fool is going to Gallatin to find Dutiful." "Ah," Chade cautioned me, "Lord Golden is going to Gallatin to hunt birds. His manservant, Tom Badgerlock, will of course accompany him. I hope that in the course of running down birds you'll pick up the trail of the prince, but that, of course, is our private errand." "So I'm going with him." "Of course." Chade peered at me. "Are you all right, Fitz? You seem wool-witted this morning." "I am. It seems that all is happening so fast." I didn't say to him that I had become accustomed to ordering my own life and journeys. It felt strange to revert to living each day as another person decreed. I swallowed my protests. What had I expected? If we were to regain Prince Dutiful, this was how it must be. I struggled to find new footing for my thoughts. "Does Lady Brisinga have a daughter?" Chade considered. "No, only the son, Sybil. I believe she fostered a girl cousin for a time. That would have been Philip Brisinga. She is, let me see, I think she would be nearly 13 now. She has returned home since spring." I shook my head, both in denial and in wonder.
Shade had obviously refreshed his information on the Brisinga family since last night. I sensed a woman, not a child, an attractive woman. I had nearly said seductive. When I thought back to my experience of the night before, the dream became mine, and I recalled only too well how she had stirred my blood, tantalizing, challenging. I glanced back at Shade. He was watching my face with undisguised dismay. I asked the next question. Has Dutiful expressed an interest in a woman? Might they have run away together?
Ada forbid, Shade exclaimed fervently. No.
He denied it almost desperately.
There is no woman in Dutiful's life, not even a girl he finds attractive. We have been very careful not to allow him the opportunity to develop such a bond. Catrican and I decided long ago that it would be for the best.
More quietly, he added, she did not want to see her son torn, as you were, between heart and duty. Have you never wondered how different things might have been if you had not loved Molly, if you had accepted your match with Lady Celerity? I have. But I will never regret loving Molly. I think the vehemence in my voice persuaded Shade to change tack.
There is no such love in Dutiful's life, he declared with finality.
There wasn't. There may be now, I contradicted him.
Then I pray it is a youthful infatuation, one that can be swiftly...
He searched for a word.
Terminated,
he said at last, and winced at his own choice. The boy is already promised.
Don't look at me like that, Fitz.
Obediently, I looked away. I do not think he has known her long. Part of her allure was her mystery. Then we must endeavour to recover him swiftly with little damage done. The next question was my own, asked for me.
What if he does not wish to be recovered?
I asked in a low voice. Shade was silent for a moment. Then he said heartily,
Then you must do as you think best.
My shock must have been apparent on my face, for he laughed aloud.
For there is little use in my pretending that you will do otherwise, is there?
He drew a breath and sighed it out.
Fitz, I ask only this. Think in large terms. A boy's heart is a precious thing, as is a man's life, but the well-being of all the people of the six duchies and the out-islands is even more precious. So do what you think best, but be sure you truly have given it thought.
I can't believe you are allowing me that much leeway, I exclaimed.
Can't you? Well, perhaps I know you better than you think I do.
Perhaps, I conceded, but I wondered if he knew me as well as he thought he did.
Well, you arrived only a few days ago, and here I am sending you off again,
Shade abruptly observed. He clapped me on the shoulder, but his smile seemed a bit forced. Think you can be ready to leave in an hour or so?
I've not much to pack, but I'll need to make a trip down to Buckkeep Town to leave a message for Hap with Jinnah.
I can take care of that for you, Shade offered. I shook my head. She doesn't read, and if I am to be Tom Badgerlock, then I wouldn't have folk running errands for me. I'll take care of it. I didn't tell him that I wanted to do it myself.
As you wish, he replied. Let me prepare a note for the boy to present to Master Gindest when he goes to him about his apprenticeship. The rest will be done subtly, I promise you. The joiner will believe he takes Hap on as a favour to one of his most affluent customers.
Shade paused a moment.
You know, all we can offer the boy is a chance to prove himself. I can't force the man to keep him on if Hap is clumsy or lazy.
At my outraged look, Shade grinned.
But I am sure he is not. Just allow me a moment to compose my note for Hap to carry.
It took more than a moment, of course. When I finally had it in hand, I found myself hurrying after the fleeing morning. I encountered Lord Golden in his chambers when I emerged from my own dark little cell. He clucked over the state of my slept-in clothes and commanded that I pick up my new garments from the tailor so that I would have appropriate garb for our journey. He informed me that we would travel alone, and swiftly. Lord Golden had already established a reputation for both eccentricity and adventurousness. No one would look askance at this expedition. He also told me that he had himself selected a horse for me and was having it freshly shod. I could pick her up from a smithy. He assumed I would wish to select my own tack and gave me a letter of credit for that as well before sending me on my way. At no time did he vary from his Lord Golden manners, and I maintained my demeanour as Tom Badgerlock.
These were roles we had to settle into as swiftly as possible. No errors could be made once we began to move in public. By the time I finally set out for Buckkeep Town, I was laden with errands, and the sun was moving far too swiftly across the sky. The tailor sought to delay me with a final fitting and adjustment of my new clothes. I refused and did not even open the bundled garments to inspect them. I could tell Scrandon was a